You are listening to Aloud, a program of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Visit us at lfla.org. Good evening, everyone. Oh, how nice. Welcome to Aloud. I'm Jessica Strand, the Director of Public Programs here at the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. And before we begin tonight's program, in the spirit of reconciliation, the Los Angeles Public Library recognizes and acknowledges the First Peoples of this land. We pay our respect to their elders, past and present, and extend that respect to all indigenous peoples today. For those not familiar with the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, we are a private nonprofit organization devoted to fundraising, advocacy, and innovative programming in the support of the Los Angeles Public Library. Thank you to any members who might be here in the audience for coming with us this evening. If you are not yet a member or a supporter, I hope you will consider supporting the Library Foundation to continue to see programs like this one and to increase critical access to information, resources, and technology to help Angelenos improve their lives. You can support through joining in the lobby at our membership table or by scanning this QR code right here on the screen to my right. Actually, to my left. I'm also like to thank our sponsors, the estate of Suzanne E. Aron, Errant Fox Shift, the Hearst Foundations, the Hollywood Foreign Press Association, the Los Angeles County Department of Arts and Culture, and individual Library Foundation donors and members. Also, a big thanks to Skylight Books for providing the books and for their support this evening. Our programs are underway. In fact, we only have two exciting programs left after this one, and I encourage you to join us this fall as we delve deeply into the theme of identity. Esteemed writers, poets, and journalists share their own lives and create work that makes us better understand who we are individually, collectively helping us to grasp who we are in our communities and as part of the larger world. To learn more about the last two programs of the season, please visit lfla.org/aloud. And now, for tonight's evening, and you've all been waiting patiently, award-winning journalist Santi Elijah-Holly brings us a long overdue look at the Shakur family, who, for over 50 years, have inspired generations of activists, scholars, and music fans. An American Family is the story of a fight for Black liberation in the United States as experienced by the Shakurs. For Assata Shakur, the popular author and thinker living for three decades in Cuba in exile, to the late great rapper Tupac, to the roots in the Black Panther movement and beyond, the Shakurs have been in the forefront of fighting for racial justice in the United States. As the Los Angeles Times put so succinctly, quote, "The greatest triumph of an American family is the way Holly expertly blends archival research, including court documents, congressional transcripts, FBI records, and newspaper clippings, with oral history to tell human stories that are at once exceptional and recognizable." Santi Elijah-Holly is an award-winning journalist and writer. His writing has appeared in numerous national and international outlets, including The Guardian, The Atlantic, The New Republic, Time, and The Washington Post. Tonight, he will be in conversation with Dr. Malina Abdullah, who is a professor of Pan-African Studies at Cal State Los Angeles, co-founder of the Black Lives Matter Los Angeles, director of Black Lives Matter Grassroots, and a leader in the California Faculty Association. Abdullah has authored numerous articles and book chapters, is the creator, host, and the producer of the radio programs Move the Crowd on KPFK, and This Is Not a Drill on KBLA. Please help me in welcoming Santi Elijah-Holly and Dr. Malina Abdullah. Thank you.
Hello. Thank you all so much for being here tonight. I've really been looking forward to this. I'm glad that you're all here. Thanks to Jessica for that introduction. Thanks to Tiffany, Jorge, Aloud, Library Foundation of LA, the LA Public Library. Thanks to all you all for being here. And thanks to Dr. Melina Abdullah for joining me tonight. I think what we're gonna do is, I'm just gonna just give a quick little, not really background, just a little synopsis of the book. And then we're just gonna have a conversation up here. So the book, An American Family, The Shakurs and the Nation They Created, is not a traditional biography of one family. It's not a genealogical story of one particular family. It's not a complete biography. It's more the history of the times in which these individuals lived, the things that they faced, the things that they survived, the institutional forces that they were up against, and where we are today. Because of the work that they did. The subtitle of the book is The Shakurs and the Nation They Created. The nation, a nation isn't necessarily a nation state. It doesn't have to be like the United States is a nation state, right? A nation can be a group of individuals who come together with, united under a common cause, whether sharing religious background, ethnic background, or just a common sort of political background, forming a sort of nation of themselves to better their community. And that's the nation that I feel like the Shakurs and the people that they were surrounded by really worked to develop. They were a new African nation. And they worked on supporting and building up the new African nation. Now, a lot of nations, as nations do, nations rise, they are strong, and then they are faced with outside forces, adversaries, and they can either retreat into themselves, they can go stronger, they can break up, they can become dismantled, but even if they do, they can reform again. It's sort of a state of nations, like they're not permanent, but it's just sort of shows the resiliency of how strong they come together to sort of show how strong this nation is. And so the Shakurs, the nation they created, is not necessarily a nation that we all are a part of. It's a nation that we all sort of benefit from, but really is the new African nation that they created and they used to for the improvement of, the community, Black people in America. That's who they were fighting for. That's where their love was, that's who their community was, and that's really that's what motivated the Shakurs and the people that they worked with, was the love of Black people and the wanting to improve, the condition of Black folks in America. So that's really what the book more or less is about, as seen through the eyes of the revolutionary Shakur family. And the Shakur family, again, is not a sort of traditional family like we think of family as being all blood relatives. They are family by, allegiance, by joining this tribe, by saying we are committed to the Black liberation struggle. So a lot of people took the name Shakur for themselves to show that sort of allegiance and that sort of commitment. And it wasn't done lightly. To become a Shakur was not something that you would do just because you wanted to. You like the name, the way it sounded. To become a Shakur was a sign of respect to the family, respect to the movement, and showing that you were committed to the struggle. And so we get to meet many of the Shakurs, the patriarchs, the first Shakurs, and sort of who they were, what they survived, and where we are today, and what we can do today to continue the work that they began 50 years ago. So I'd love to, just from there, just chop it up a little bit.
Well, let me say, I was honored that you asked me to be in conversation, and you didn't know this at the time when you asked to be in conversation, but many of us, I saw about half the people in this group out in the streets just a minute ago. So Black Lives Matter, we regularly protest in the streets. If Baba Keeley were here, is he here? No. He would say, every Wednesday, I won't say it like him because it'll be loud. Every Wednesday we protest the police associations, which are not unions. So we're in the street every single Wednesday pushing back against the LA Police Protective League, pushing back against the Association of Los Angeles Deputy Sheriffs, and what Black Lives Matter has been and strives to be is really in the last chapter of the book, or last couple of chapters, when you talk about Tupac Shakur and the kind of his desire to give a rebirth to the Black Panther Party. You know, we understand that we hail from generations that predate the Shakurs to Black liberation. And so understanding that, it also means that we're very connected. And so when your book first came out, we were welcoming home Baba Mutulu Shakur. And so we had been part of the work that the Malcolm X grassroots movement was leading to try to get Baba Mutulu free, and ultimately won his freedom in December of last year, and were very fortunate to spend a lot of time with him over the 7-month period between when he was freed and his recent passing. You mentioned names that, you know, were in the streets and were actually part of the birth of Black Lives Matter, names like Dida and Kamathi, right? Mm-hmm. Names like McKinney, right? And so I felt like it was really important the way in which the book tells these stories and, you know, lifts up that it's not just a pretty name, and it is a pretty name, right? but it's not just a pretty name. It's really about pledging your commitment to Black liberation and Black freedom with all of yourself. And so I'd love for us to, I said that this moment is a moment, I think, in especially Black political history, where we're questioning and raising up what it means to defend ourselves, the role of Black self-defense. This is also the 10-year, you mentioned Baba AK is what we call him, but Akinyele
Okoro. We will shoot back, yeah.
Right,
yeah.
Right. We will shoot back is celebrating its 10th year, where they talk about Deacons for Defense and Robert F. Williams and all of this other work. And so I think also, like what's happening around the world, is a moment where we question not just our right to self-defense, but our duty of self-defense. So for me, you know, admitting that I sometimes finish my homework late, right? Over the last week of trying to finish the book, I think it also landed for me in the current political climate, where we're questioning what the role of self-defense is for oppressed people. Mm-hmm. And I said, I promise we won't talk all the time about that, but I just wanted to
It's a good point. I mean, it's an important question that I think comes up with this, with in the book, sort of at the beginning of the Black Power movement, with the Black Panthers, the question of self-defense. It's sort of to unpack and define self-defense. I mean, I think a lot of people would say self-defense is when your immediate person is threatened. If you feel like you were immediately threatened and you do something to protect yourself, obviously that's self-defense. You could take that a little further and say, well, what if your community is threatened by some force outside that is threatening your community? It's not necessarily threatening your individual person. Then at that point, is retribution self-defense? Is defending your community self-defense? I mean, that's the question that, you know, I feel like when Huey P. Newton and Bobby Seale formed the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense, which was their original name in Oakland, in 1965, it was self-defense of your immediate person and encouraging people to defend themselves against violence, specifically police violence. I think that the definition then, when other people sort of joined and the party grew, I think that question of self-defense also grew. It's like, are we just concerned with our own individual selves or our community? And what is then, is that being proactive? If we are being proactively self-defensive, is that self-defense or is that retribution? And that's a question I think a lot of people over the years in the book, the family, you know, just people who are involved in the movement, I think that's something that you have to sort of ask of yourself and people around you you know, what the goal is, or the motivation, or the, at least the end goal. Is it defense of and liberation and self-determination, or is it just we just want to end police violence against, you know, us individually in our community and our neighbors, or are we looking more broadly? You know, and that's a question that I think, you know, we're still asking today. I mean, I think that question came up then. I think it's still something that we're still trying to define what it means to, you know, what defense means, what self-defense means.
Right. And so for folks who haven't read it, and I think probably most of the audience hasn't read the book yet, right, I love how the book begins before the start in earnest of the Black Power Movement, which I always say 1965 is that watershed year, right? 1965, when we talk about the assassination of Malcolm X, when we talk about, you know, the winning of the Voting Rights Act, when we talk about the rise of urban resistance here in Watts, right? You know, the Watts Rebellion of 1965. I love that you begin before that, right? And then I love that there's a through line to the current period. So what we look at, I think many of us are familiar with the Black Panther Party. We don't always know all of the influences. And so when we talk about self-defense, it's really important that we understand that self-defense is a theme that predates the Black Power Movement, and that we can actually take all the way back to even before we were stolen from the shores of Africa, right? That Mama Harriet carried a gun on her back, right? Mm-hmm. That Ida B. Wells said a Winchester rifle should have a place of honor in every Black home, right? That when we talk about by any means necessary, Malcolm actually meant by any means necessary. And all of these are influences that are picked up by, yes, members of the Black Panther Party. And your book writes specifically about New York Panthers, right? Mm-hmm. So we're talking about the Shakurs as having an East Coast base, even though they're everywhere, right? Then they have a West Coast influence. And, right. You know, but I think it's really important in this moment to think about what self-defense means. And then also think about, as you talk about family, right, that what ties together this family is both blood and spirit, and also a commitment to the shared vision and a duty to usher in a shared vision of Black freedom that you can't get just by hoping and praying for it to come, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. So, and then finally, this is the last thing I'm not gonna promise. last thing on self-defense, I'll try, right, to make it the last thing on self-defense. I think that it's important that we not impose kind of a universal application of self-defense. So when you talk about, you know, white supremacist terrorists like George Zimmerman, who claimed self-defense and then the court backed him, right? Mm-hmm. You're not talking about the same thing as when you're talking about, you know, Kwame Ture and Charles Hamilton talk about us, Black people in the United States, as being a colonized body, even though it's not the traditional form of colonization because, you know, we don't have land, which is why NAPO and other groups say right. Free the land, right? Mm-hmm. That when you talk about Black people engaging in self-defense, and it's not just in resistance to an immediate or impending attack on your personage. You're talking about something else that doesn't apply to those who are the oppressor. So self-defense for the oppressed means something different than when the oppressor tries to invoke self-defense.
Hmm. Yeah, and you brought up NAPO, and that's North New African Political Organization, and this sort of grew out of Republic in New Africa, which is a secessionist group that advocates for independent Black nation in the American South, in the Black Belt. And that's, I mean, if that could, and are you saying that that could be also sort of a proactive way of self-defense, of just saying we need our own land, our own nation, that's the best form of defense, sort of just sort of taking the offense at that point?
Well, I would say this, And I want to make sure I don't get myself in more trouble. I know I'm already on a lot of lists, right? I would say that there's validity to the idea, oh, wait, we got hella BLM people. When we say who keeps us safe, what do we say?
We keep us safe.
Who keeps us safe?
We keep us safe.
Oh, Baba Keeley is here. So I think that when we talk about self-defense, we have to remember that the guy standing in the back of the room would shoot me quicker than he would defend me, right? And so the ideas that are presented of having a collective form of even physical self-defense, I think is really important for oppressed people, because the apparatus of the state is not there to keep Black people safe. So an MXGM strategy or a NAPO strategy or a Republic of New Africa strategy of saying we want to close ranks, as Kwame Ture would say, right? We want to close ranks and we want to free the land and we want everybody move to Jackson, right? I think all of that is valid, as is the idea, and this is where we get into some kind of interesting conversations that I love to have about Black people and self-defense. So as people think, well, if you're progressive, you think nobody should have a gun. Well, first of all, my people are from Beaumont, Texas, and they believe everybody should have a gun, right? Mm-hmm. Or all Black people should have a gun. But you mean something different, right, when we talk about self-defense. And it doesn't always mean guns. It does mean shared space. I feel much safer in my community than I do if I'm whisked off somewhere else where nobody else is going to defend me. Mm-hmm. So anyway, that was a long answer.
And I think it's also important to know that, I mean, not everything that the Shakurs were involved with was as glamorous or controversial, even as self-defense, the right to have weapons training, independent land. A lot of what they're talking about also was quieter things, just community health care, tenants' rights, organizing tenants, school education rights, feeding hungry school children. A lot of the things that we think about the Black Panther Party and about the Black Power movement and the Black Liberation movement, sometimes it does get a little wrapped up in just sort of those things, of just sort of the things that we may have learned about the Black Panther Party, just sort of the images that we see of them with holding the shotguns and the black berets and the black leather jackets. A lot of anytime anybody really, if they learn at all about the Black Panther Party, that's kind of all they know, is those famous images of them. But it was important to me to show that it was much more than that, and that there was much more quieter community work. The late Dr. Mutulu Shakur, was practicing acupuncture, one of the first people to really utilize acupuncture as a way of detoxing people from heroin withdrawal symptoms. And Afeni Shakur, which is Tupac's mother, was doing just all sorts of tenants organizing people's tenants who are being exploited by their landlords, showing them how to put money into an escrow, just things like that that I really wanted to highlight, to sort of just say, like, this is a rich history, and that I feel like my job or my role or responsibility as a writer, not somebody who's out there, actually, we talked about this before, like doing the work like you do, out in the streets. I wanted to document this history, not as a end-all, be-all, this is the conversation, this is all you need to know right here. This is more just, I wanted it to be like, this is just the beginning, this is just a story, this is like, one side of the story. The story is much more rich, much more, deeper than I could, put between two covers. But I really wanted to show, like, this is the stuff that I didn't know about before really going into this book. I hadn't really learned a lot of this history until I really got involved with working on this book. And I felt like I learned so much more, just even about, just not just about, Dr. Mutulu Shakur and Afeni, but just about the movement itself and about Malcolm X and how Malcolm X really you know, started, just so many people were so adrift and just looking for ways to continue his message in the best ways they could. And a lot of people had different ways of going about that, about carrying on his legacy and his mission. And, you know, I think that we still are, you know, having those conversations. And I was hoping that this book would be add to that conversation, saying, look at this, this is what they overcame, this is what they did, and this is what they accomplished. This is also what they, you know, it's like not just an inspirational story. I wanted to be inspirational, but it's also cautionary. Like, there's a lot of things that they didn't know what they were up against.
I have like 5 questions for you.
Okay.
But the first one is, why did you write this? Like, what brought you to this? Yeah.
Yeah, because really it was Tupac, because I, you know, I'm an old head hip hop fan. I was into Tupac back when he was still alive in the 90s, but I didn't really know the depth of what he was talking about. You know, to me it was just, you know, his party anthems, it's just, you know, his bangers. And as I got older and I sort of looked more deeply into his lyrics and his interviews, as I was sort of becoming interested in writing more about how art and social activism really interact and intersect, I looked again at Tupac's lyrics and I learned just how, just the depth of what he's talking about, just how prescient he was and just how knowledgeable he was about a lot of these things, like just this movement. He was name dropping people I'd never heard of. So when I looked more deeply into that, I learned more about his mother, Afeni, and how she was an influential Black Panther, and what she did and what she accomplished. So like, also, you know, me and like a lot of other Tupac fans really only knew Afeni through his, you know, that song Dear Mama, where he talks about her struggle with a drug addiction. But the more I learned about her, I was just like, wow, this is deep. Like, I want to know more about her. And then I learned about Matulu Shakur and what he was doing in the Bronx in Lincoln Hospital, treating people with acupuncture. And I was just like, why isn't this all together? And like, who else is involved? And it became sort of just a labor of love at the first. I just wanted to know about it as a passion project. I just really wanted to learn more about what they did and sort of spread the word a little bit as much as I could. And just the more I learned about this family and people that they were involved with and people that they inspired and the things that they overcame, I just really felt it was important to share the story. So I really just, it was really just personal interest, and then just like, wow, like I really feel like this story is so important to share just to for other people like myself who maybe didn't know this history growing up, but really want to put these pieces together of who these folks are and, you know, what they did and what they accomplished.
So the book talks about Pac at the end. You introduce him, you know, earlier, but, you know, the last couple of chapters are really dedicated to Pac. But it also talks about Asada, it talks about Afeni, it talks about Baba Matulu, talks about Sekou Odinga, who also we've been hugely influenced by in Black Lives Matter. It talks about lots of different folks, and it weaves together all of these stories. And one of the things I shared with you before this event and when we talked is I just have a lot of respect for the level of research that you had to do. And so can you talk a little bit about that? Like, how did you gather all of this data? And it's not boring when you say words like data, it sounds hella boring, right? It's like so many stories that are told, and I love the way that you do it because, you know, it's exciting. And it's true, right? Mm-hmm. And it's backed up. Like, well, how did they break Asada out of prison, right? Mm-hmm. And then I asked you, is anybody going to get in trouble based on what you wrote? And, you know, no. But, yeah.
Yeah, no, I mean, everybody at this point who nobody's going to get in trouble. Everybody's been acquitted or they've done their time and can't be relitigated, recharged for the same thing that they were already acquitted for, or already served the time and were paroled for. So no, I didn't want to publish anything that would have gotten anybody into hot water. A lot of things like the research was a lot of just person-to-person interviews. You know, a lot of folks are still based in New York And so I spent some time out there just talking to people, which it was a process. I mean, a lot of the research was independent research, reading a lot of books, combing through court transcripts, police records, old newspaper archives. But really, the most rewarding and I think the most valuable research was just meeting people face-to-face and talking to them on the phone, you know, in person, and really hearing their stories just from themselves. And things like, yeah, Asada's liberation from prison was something that I actually did grapple with a little bit personally, whether or not to, you know, because in her autobiography, she doesn't talk about it at all. She doesn't, she just says, you know, one page, she says, I decided to break out of prison, or I decided to leave prison. Next page, and she's in Cuba. And I was like, you know, like, that's, if she didn't want her that business known, who am I to you know, to air that business out? But I'm also just like, well, she's, I mean, she's pretty, I mean, safely, you know, safe in Cuba. I mean, as far as, I don't think that
the way you wrote it doesn't jeopardize her.
Right. The people right. who were involved, with her liberation from prison, have already sort of spoken for themselves. They've been tried for it. I mean, charges have come up. The people who were involved, the way that she was, it was a phenomenal way that. This team, this very well-organized team at the time, was very well-organized in the way that they broke
out
of prison.
It was brilliant.
It was really brilliant. Yeah. And, yeah. I mean, no shots fired. Nobody was, you know, nobody was killed. Nobody was shot. And I just feel like this is such an important story that I just feel like, how can anybody keep this to themselves? And I don't, you know, and the people who I spoke with who were either directly or indirectly accused of being involved, you know, and I think that's the sort of thing. Like, these are the stories that the things that happen, the events that happen in the book. You know, a lot of these things are just accusations. I try not to say too much. They definitely did this or that, and this is what they're guilty of. These are the things that they were accused of. And so the people who liberated Asada, you know, they were later accused of that, and they later were charged with aiding and embedding her, you know, escape. But yeah, but that sort of research was like, I want to be respectful. I don't want to, you know, call anybody. I don't want to get anybody in trouble. But I do want to share these stories that I feel like are so important and also inspirational with people who were just like, how did this happen? How did they accomplish so much? And I just wanted to share those stories. And I just feel like, you know, talking to people directly and with them sharing their stories with me, it's like, well, if you're sharing it with me, I feel like that is, you know, I don't know. That's inspiring to me that you know, trusted me with these stories, first of all. And so by writing the story and by collecting it all together in this one place, I just feel like then that was my way of being sincere, being like at least honoring their trust with telling me these stories. So I really just want to honor their trust and say, if you trust me with the story, then I'm not gonna like twist it, you know, any way that goes against the truth of what I learned from you or learned from the, you know, old archives or whatever.
Yeah, one of the things that was really, so there's the whole book is marked up, right? But when I want to write a note to myself, I put my little initials so that I know to track it for myself. And one of the things that we're seeing that I feel like your book could provide guidance on, one of our babas is, who you didn't mention in the book by name, like he was one of the San Francisco Eight, Baba Hank Jones, right? Mm-hmm. So you do talk a little bit about that case. I think you mentioned Herman Bell. Mm-hmm. But Baba Hank Jones is one of the San Francisco Eight, and he always says that what will tear down movements isn't only the attacks from the outside, it's what happens on the inside, like lack of discipline, factionalism mm-hmm. on the inside. And so as I was reading, especially about the Black Panther Party, because you talk about several different organizations, the Black Panther Party, Black Liberation Army, you get to NAPO, you get to RAM, you talk about RNA, bunch of different organizations. But when you talk about the Black Panther Party, it was really clear that it's important to stay disciplined. And I think this is for all of us, right? To think about the role, the other thing Baba Hank always says is the most important work we do as individuals is killing our egos, right? So the way in which we have to kill our egos and make sure that any conflicts that we have are like principled conflicts, right? So the note that I wrote to myself is to really examine that, not just for me, but within organization. How do we make sure that we have conflicts when they need to be had, but also not squander moments when we can move us down a road for Black liberation because we're so tied to our egos that we don't see the points or the ideas or the paths that other people lay. And so I think that was a really important kind of teaching from the narratives that you include in the book.
Yeah, that's a really important piece to bring up because the Black Panther Party did face a lot of factionalism, a lot of infighting and a lot of ego. I mean, there's some people, there's some men specifically who were very, who just wanted control, who wanted things done their way. And they had their followers. I'm talking about Huey Newton and Eldridge Cleaver, who people were very loyal to, one or the other. And it wasn't, you know, they were also up against COINTELPRO and against the FBI and against a lot of just, you know, infiltration, falsification of letters, you know, fabrication of things and phony phone calls, pitting them against each other.
Right.
But they also, I mean, outside of, they didn't know that they were being used basically against each other. And I think, you know, now we have the virtue after years and after COINTELPRO has been exposed, we have the virtue of looking back and saying, you know, how could you fight amongst each other so much? How could you do this? You really killed this great organization or you let it be destroyed. But they didn't know, you know, they didn't know that they were being infiltrated. They didn't know that, you know, that J. Edgar Hoover's FBI was actively dividing them.
Like the number of informants mm-hmm. and their placement and then even stuff like the role of intimate relationships, right? And, you know, you let your heart guide you when it actually risks people's lives, mm-hmm. right? And the importance of being disciplined around those kinds of things and how ego and factionalism opened it up. So it was COINTELPRO, and it was also like, how do we guard against COINTELPRO by being more disciplined and by being able, and for me, you don't say this in the book, the stepping back and engaging in like meditative practice or, you know, stilling yourself so you can, yes, have your emotions, but there's a saying, emotions make wonderful followers, terrible leaders. And like there was emotionalism that sometimes opened up space for COINTELPRO to get in,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah, and I think the way that when they learned what was happening, that they had been infiltrated so thoroughly, some folks, that's sort of where, you know, I mean, we can't really get into the whole time with time. The BLA, the Black Liberation Army, that's really where that starts. It's sort of saying, we cannot operate above ground anymore. Like the Black Panther Party was above ground, accepting donations from supporters, talking to the press. You knew who they were. They're very. That's how they were so easily to be infiltrated, because you could just go into their office and sign up. BLA, the Black Liberation Army, was the sort of more radical offshoot from the Black Panther Party. And that's when they said, we're going underground, basically just to get away from, just they can't expose themselves to people anymore. Just they can't say, this is what we're doing, this is the actions we're taking. So really, that's where Asada was most active, was in the BLA. And other folks too, other Chakur members were really active in the BLA, but that grew out of that need of saying we're being exposed, we're exposing ourselves too much, we've been infiltrated. And, but without that sort of, you know, real clear leadership and goal sort of oriented actions, I think a lot of times the BLA, just we're sort of fighting to survive a lot of times, just sort of trying to stay one step ahead of the law, And it's, you know, sometimes with the Black Panther Party, you could do things like feed breakfast to school children, but the BLA didn't really have that luxury of doing things in public. They had to be underground at all times. So a lot of times, you know, when you're living underground and living on the run from the law, you're forced to sort of take desperate actions just to stay out of, you know, out of jail, or just not to be killed. So I think that's where the BLA really came into a lot of sort of devastating choices and decisions, is just because they were just fighting just to stay, you know, underground. But that's, you know, that's all chronicled in the.
I love how when you talk about BLA and you talk about like some of the robberies that they carried out and all of these things allegedly, right, that they carried out. That at first, as you were going down the road and kind of talking about how they were financing themselves, I was going, well, why were they doing that? And I love how you follow it up in these conversations with BLA members about how they called them expropriations, yeah, and what that money was supposed to be used for. And so I'm wondering if you want to, do you think like that was a chipping away, as Baba Sekou would say, of, you know, against capitalism, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, yeah, Baba Sekou Odinga would definitely say these are expropriations because this money belongs to the community. I mean, they've been exploiting the community for so long, for so many years, to go into a bank and to, you know, it's not a bank robbery or an armored truck, like a Brinks armored truck robbery. It's an expropriation because the money that they were taking from these banks, they would use to further the revolution that they believed was in their lifetime, that they were going to, you know, this was guerrilla warfare. And it's not, you know, you need money for safe houses, for getaway cars, for ammunition, for weapons.
And to eat.
But so at that point, how much money, you know, it's sort of this constant need for funds just to fund the your fight itself. And to say we're expropriating money to give back to the community, it's hard to justify when most of that money is just going towards, you know, basically just like what you need to survive, food, houses, you know. I think that's where they sort of, it kind of start to lose the narrative, lose the plot, is when these expropriations and the funds that were, you know, gathered from these expropriations were mostly just going towards continuing to fight rather than actually what they wanted. I mean, I think the ultimate goal for many people, not for everybody, but you know, there was this hope of having land in the South, of being able to purchase land, and that would be, you know, a training ground, Republic of New Africa. But that would be, I mean, just that having that as your goal, to have to say we're going to, like the U.S. government is going to give up significant land in the American South. You know, that's been tried before.
But you didn't talk about that part. Like Chokwe Lumumba moved there. Right, and when you think about organizations like Cooperation Jackson that are in there that own, I think now it's up to like almost 30 pieces of property, including farmland, right? It's not necessarily what the U.S. government will give up. It's also what you can get, right? So I think that last one, though, what was it, 1.6 million?
The last job?
Yeah. Like, I think it was envisioned not just will the government give it up, but with 1.6 million in the 1980s, how much can you just buy?
Yeah, I mean, at that point, then it's just then you're just buying land. I mean, then I think that is not necessarily revolutionary in itself. And I think that's, you know, I think they that is just purchasing land, which I think is, you know, really, I think that's what, you know, Chokwe Lumumba and what people did eventually, and the RNA sort of split off too, because there's people who believed in just purchasing land and raising money for buying land, and there's others who believed in just taking the land. And I think that, you know, everybody had a different means of achieving the same end. And what ended up being the most successful was just, I don't know, just purchasing the land and raising a homestead that way.
But if you buy the land with capitalist funds, with the funds you took from the capitalist class, I think that's revolutionary.
Yeah.
Yeah.
do we?
I think we're supposed to go to Q&A now, yeah. Right? Are we? Yes. Okay. I don't think we have a basket of questions. So are we going to... Okay.
Thank you so much for what you've given us so far. It's been amazing. As an African American, it feels like, I said we, but I will be specific and say I, can clearly point to the Black freedom and liberation movement of the older decades, the 50s, the 60s, and so on, that there are in the history books and archived. I can read about things. I can read about Marshall, and I can read about what the NAACP did and those victories that they had through many layers of the movement. And I want to ask you, why does it feel like the movement has been diminished or washed out to the extent that I currently struggle to identify the leaders, the methodologies, the tentacles, even the successes of the our movement today? And I wrote BLM excluded. Thank you.
Well, I think that when you read this book, right, but also any student who sincerely engages in the study of both the civil rights movement and the Black Power movement will come to understand that even though we know names like Martin Luther King, you know names like Huey P. Newton, that they were never very big organizations, right? So we have to think about how information is manipulated now to make you think that the movement now is smaller than it is. Black Lives Matter is the largest racial justice movement in history. And so we can't say BLM excluded, right? Because it's the largest movement in history. And so it never looked like, I think it's really important what Santi is lifting up when we talk about survival programs, right? That we need to think about survival programs like the free breakfast program, like the after school tutoring programs, but also like the political education work, and the whole concept of healing justice that Baba Mutulu ushered in as revolutionary. But those were not thought of as, you know, when we think about what's fed to us, this is what the Black Panther Party is, you think of men with guns in the Sacramento State House, right? But that's never been really what the revolution was. And you're talking about maybe hundreds of people, but never thousands of people. So what we have to, I think, lift up, and what I draw from as inspiration from this book, is that the work that we're doing is really, really important. And we can't allow the effort, even though it's not called COINTELPRO anymore, there is a deliberate effort. If there was a deliberate and successful effort in the 1960s and 70s to kill movement, what do you think is happening in 2023? There's a deliberate effort to erase Black Lives Matter. Even when you talk about, sometimes we'll have 1,000 people in the streets, it's not covered on the news, right? So what we need to do is make sure that we're all engaged. And I'll be quiet after this. My mother, so I grew up in Oakland, California. I don't know if you know that, but I'm from Oakland. And I'm born in 1972, which I started saying my age because the alternative is terrible, right? So I am Panther Cub generation. And I think that it's important that we understand it's time for us to step in, be inspired, draw inspiration, and say that it's not what they say about us, it's what we know to be true and how we're going to engage. And so it's incumbent on all of us to figure out what your contribution, what our contribution to contemporary movement is. And if you live in Los Angeles, I am personally inviting you to Black Lives Matter Los Angeles. We do at least two actions a week. And there's all the stuff that happens beneath the surface, which again, in the book, it talks about like everything wasn't just what protest you're going to do. There was a lot of conversation and political education that happens behind the scenes. So let's make sure we keep this movement going, because is that Jason? No, I thought I saw Jason. We all have children, or I have children, right? You two? They deserve a world better than this. They deserve a world better than this, and it's our sacred duty to build that world for them.
I just want to quickly just piggyback on that, because that's really beautifully put. I could not have said that any better. And I also just want to, sort of say that, like, we have the benefit or disadvantage of looking back on what the movements of the 60s and 70s and saying, oh, these, you know, they were so organized. We had these great leaders like Martin Luther King and Malcolm X and Kwame Ture. And so why don't we have that now? But at the time, they were just putting in the work, and they were just people who were just, you know, they weren't exalted like they are today. They were figuring things out sort of as we all are today. So, you know, it's really like the quieter work, you know, we don't have to look for leaders to repeat what they were doing, you know, to sort of say, we need another Huey Newton, we need another Malcolm X. No, we just need people who are willing to put in the work, just the day-to-day work, just, you know, the quiet work, just community work, and that's really what it's all about. And then years from later, you know, our kids or whatever, next generation will look back and be like, oh, you know, they did so much back then, you know? So it's really just like looking ahead to the sort of the final goal, rather than like, why don't we have this? It's like, well, we should be doing that. We can be doing that. And this really is just the quieter work, the community work, the survival programs, even though we call them different things now, but it really is just like, what can we do here and now without having to worry about, you know, what is the movement doing? Because the movement is just whatever we're doing, right?
What I'm gonna just add this real quick. What I love about the book too is, so some of these people, like I said, are people we know, and we know what they did, kind of, but we didn't know as much as they did, right? And so I think it gives for me like a deeper respect for what they put on the line, what they sacrificed. And what I love is you also mixed that with these are human beings who had flaws. Right. Like Baba Mutulu, when he was young, he smoked too much damn weed, right? You know, and it's important. I think those flaws are important too, because we're also trained to believe that you have to be like a Messiah in order to do work. You have to be, you know, the second coming of Christ in order to do work. You don't. You can eat too much. You know, you can make mistakes. You know, you can sometimes say the wrong shit to your friends, right?
Yeah,
I like that.
Yeah, thank you for saying that, because I really did want to not just, you know, make... Actually, one of my favorite quotes, there's this woman, Yasmin Fula, who is mother of Yaki Fula, friend of the family, friend of a Fannie Shakur. And I spoke to her, and she said something to me, and she's just like, people want to make Asada and Afeni into these superwomen. Like, they're not superheroes, they're not superwomen. They just did some super women ass shit. Like, they were not perfect. And you know, like, you know, I'll bring in, you know, Tupac, obviously not a perfect, very flawed, a flawed spokesperson, a flawed, you know, person, but he was dealing with a lot of trauma from what he survived with his family and the things that his family survived. But all of them were dealing with trauma. They were just trying to survive, and they just had the whole repressive forces coming down against them. So they made a lot of mistakes, and it was important for me to show that a lot of things they did or that they were accused of came from a good place, came from, you know, a good heart. They really wanted to, their heart was in the right place. Like, they really wanted to better the conditions of Black people in America. That's their motivation. And then along the way, mistakes were made, and they learned from them and kept going. You know, they just kept that fight. And I think that's, you know, something that's like, yeah, you don't expect to be perfect. Don't expect your, you know, comrades to be perfect. They'll make mistakes too. And we're all kind of just trying to figure it out together. But as long as we keep our, you know, hearts in the right place, we'll get through those mistakes, get through those, you know, various things that we have to, you know, get through. But, you know, we'll survive in the long run. Any other questions?
Last question for tonight. Thank you both. I appreciate your presentation, and thanks for taking this question from someone who's not a member of the African-American community. I was listening to a radio show today, and they had a someone speaking, Daruba Bin Wahad, and he had mentioned something that I just wanted to posit, not as a critique, but as a question in the way that he presented it. He said, black academics would be better served getting away from identity politics and making sure they're providing strategic visions activists can act upon. And I just wanted to know what organizations or how you see that happening now, that there's actual strategic visions that people are acting on. Thank you.
I don't think I'm on the stage, I'm not the authority on that.
I think that there are, so Daruba often poses complicated questions, right? And I think that we need to remember that when you talk about getting free, when you talk about quest for freedom, there's multiple ways in which you engage. And so I disagree with the idea that those who do intellectual work should also be charting the course for on-the-ground work. I think that there's intellectual work that needs to be done, and people who do that intellectual work. So I was really fortunate to be in space with Kimberly Crenshaw a couple weeks ago for some time. She's an intellectual. I don't want her figuring out how to shut shit down at police commission. That's not her role, right? But Baba Akili, who's all, and I'm not saying that they're mutually exclusive categories. Obviously, my paycheck is from a university, right? But Baba Akili has, how many years you got in? 50 years? 52 years into revolutionary work for black people. I want him to talk about how and why we should be shutting shit down. So I think that, you know, we have many, many different ways to enter movement. So some as intellectuals, some as on the ground organizers, some as artists, some as in the movement. We have in BLMLA, we have this one sister named Jan who, anything she asks you to do, you gonna do that shit. I don't know why, but if Jan calls you and says, hey, we need you on Saturday to help pack these produce bags, you're gonna show up, right? So there's all these different ways of entering movement, and so I would respectfully disagree with Daruba on that and just say that intellectual work is important work, and the vision and the course of action to advance that vision can sometimes be determined by other people.
I have so much respect for the work that you do and that other organizers and leaders do in the community and really just day after day against really insurmountable odds. And I think there's room for both. You know, there's room for, I just feel like we kind of need them both. You know, we need somebody to document this history. If you don't know this history, you'll be oppressed by that history. You know, you just face the same things over and over again if you don't really study that history. And I just feel like that was, you know, that's the role of writers, academics, scholars, is to share these stories in an honest way, so that we can all work together in tandem. You know, and I think I do. Before we close, I just want to read just a little, just to close it out with a little. Just a brief reading from the end of the introduction to this book, and then I think we'll wrap it up. The legacy of the Shakur family exists all around us, in culture, activism, and our professional lives. When we listen to the work of black songwriters who express both compassion and animosity, love and indifference, social consciousness and nihilism, we hear Tupac's influence. When we read the work of black poets and authors who speak to the collective black experience while also yearning for home and family, we are relating to Asada. When we demand our right to represent ourselves, whether in the courtroom or the bedroom, we are following in the path set forward by Afeni. When we seek alternative, holistic, and non-Western forms of medical treatment, we are benefiting from the groundwork laid by Matulu. The Shakurs helped magnify the beauty and possibilities of being black in America. They were a catalyst of black creativity, recovery, and above all, resistance. From above ground community organizing to clandestine armed struggle, Wherever there was a fight against persecution, Shakurs were at the forefront. They fought noble battles and won important victories. They've also made critical errors and suffered devastating losses. They have been connected to shocking acts of violence in response to the violence perpetrated against them. But through it all, they have never wavered in their commitment to the liberation of Black people in America. You can see their legacy in the streets of Ferguson, Kenosha, Minneapolis, Los Angeles, and dozens of other American cities from coast to coast. You can hear their influence on today's top musical artists, from Beyonce to Kendrick Lamar. America still has a long way to go before it can honestly say it has granted its Black citizens equal protection under the law, or that Black Americans are afforded the same right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness as white Americans. Until that day comes, and until Black people in this country have received justice for hundreds of years of persecution, America will not know peace. This is the nation the Shakurs created. Thank you very much for being here. Thank you, Dr. Melina Abdullah, for the
Thank
great
you.
Conversation. I really appreciate it.
Thank you both so much. Thank you. Thank you.
Allowed is made possible by Hearst Foundations, Golden Globes Foundation, LA County Department of Arts and Culture, Errant Fox Schiff, the Steve and Judith Krantz Foundation, Estate of Suzanne E. Aaron, and individual Library Foundation donors and members. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library. To support programs like these, become a member at lfla.org.